Jackson versus Potter. Mr. Andre?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court? Mr. Tardif?
Mr. Walsh?
Well, this is a case involving a casual employee of the Postal Service. I emphasize that point first because none of the precedents cited by the defendant in any way deals with a situation involving a casual employee. The latest case that they submitted to the court, the Smith case, involved the denial of principles of equitable estoppel because the person filed after 45 days with an EEO counselor. That involved a regular employee who had union representation and, in fact, had gone through the union grievance procedure. My client indicated that from the time she first started at the Postal Service, she was advised that as a casual employee, she had no rights of any of the regular employees. She was advised this by her supervisor. Even in the material submitted by the defendants, they point out that the supervisors are the ones who are responsible for enforcing EEO actions. So if a person had a complaint about EEO or had a question whether or not they had EEO rights, the supervisors are the ones that they would go to. For the first 3 years that my client was supervised, she was supervised by someone who hated her because of her religion, Jehovah's Witness, and who, in fact, made her a target and told her that if it were up to her, she would have fired her. Only her supervisor prevented her from doing that.
Sandy, just as a matter of interest, Ms. Jackson was employed for quite a while, wasn't she?
That's correct.
What's his casual employee status? When do you become a permanent employee?
It's unless you are hired as a regular employee, you still remain, it's a term of art, I guess, you still remain a casual employee. That means that you don't have the right to union representation, you don't have the right to benefits that other employees have.
What other benefits?
For example, she could not claim that she has the right to continue unemployment. Each year, I think they reviewed to determine whether she would be reinstated for the next year.
So is it a sort of a lesser civil service status? Is that what it is?
I'm not even certain you would call it a civil service status, but it is a lesser status, whichever.
She had year-to-year employment.
Essentially.
And she could only be discharged for cause?
I don't know that she could only be discharged for cause.
Well, what could she be discharged for?
I'm not certain. It just doesn't say clearly, and that really is not an issue here. The issue here was whether or not she could be discharged because of her religion. And obviously, that is not the case.
No, that's not a cause. But
right.
I asked what causes they did recite that could.
Well, they didn't. The only thing they indicated was that she was not being renewed. She was not being renewed. They felt that.
And they didn't give any because they didn't have enough work for her, what?
No. She had friction with her supervisor, the supervisor that she currently had. This was back in 2005. Her and that supervisor didn't get along. She also felt that was based on her religion. And so at the end of the year, December.
Well, did he make any remarks about her religion?
We never really got to that point. This was a case that was decided.
Well, how do you tie it back to her religion?
Because of the fact that in terms of her treatment, she felt that it was based on her religion, based on the way that this woman had communicated to her, talked to her in the past. We didn't go through discovery.
What did she communicate that?
That's the problem. The problem is we never went through discovery. This was a decision that was made on the pleadings. It was not a decision made after any discovery took place. So we never got to that point where we could determine that. In fact, that's part of the difficulty that we have here.
Why didn't you?
Well, because it was a motion made in response to the pleading. We filed this, or actually my client filed pro se. Then she retained me. I amended the complaint. And in response to the complaint, the amended complaint, they filed a motion to dismiss. So we never got into any discovery whatsoever. In fact, the reply that was submitted to our response to the motion for summary, the motion to dismiss and or for summary judgment.
Did you make an offer of proof to the court?
No, I did not. This was a reply that was submitted in response to our motion for our response.
But did you make an offer if you would accept it, this, and we could have a trial, this is what we would say?
There was no oral proceedings to do that. There was no protocol to do that. We had the motion.
Fine, that's good. I understand.
No, I did not make an offer of proof. We had the motion, we had the response, we had the reply. That is the customary protocol for dealing with a motion to dismiss. We had that. The reply included matters and affidavits that we were not in a position to do anything with because it was a reply. And the judge based his decision in part on the replies, affidavits that were submitted by the defendants. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Surely, Senator. Thank you. Mr. Tardif?
May it please the court, counsel. The notion, Your Honors, that there's a federal employee out there who thinks that for some reason they can be discriminated against because their job title involves the word casual, I think is a little bit out there. Ms. Jackson worked for the Postal Service in a casual status. We don't have too much in the record to address the court's questions to Mr. Andre about what that means because the case simply didn't proceed there. What I can tell you is, as Mr. Andre said, it is a temporary appointment, and she continued to receive temporary appointments for a period of time.
To Mr. Andre's point about not getting anywhere, you're hired as a casual employee by the post office, whatever status that is. I assume you're informed you're bereft of some rights, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Whatever those are. But you think you're affirmatively told that you certainly can't have your rights, you can't trampled on in a discriminatory fashion, that is, as an employee? I wonder if a casual employee told that you're without the status of the permanent employee or whatever the term of art is, might arguably think, gee, I'm without any protection. I mean, you started out your argument by saying, how can anybody believe that? I'd like to think that's the case, that everyone's possessed of a comfort level that, you know, even though I don't have full status as a permanent employee, I can't be discriminated against. But do we need discovery to find that out?
Absolutely not, Judge. What we have in the record in that regard is simply what Ms. Jackson submitted in an affidavit.
Yes, I was looking at that, yeah.
In that regard, this case is almost squarely on point with this court's decision in Smith versus Potter. In fact, I think Ms. Smith, in her case, had a slightly better argument to avoid the consequences of her failure to exhaust administrative remedies, which she obviously lost, than Ms. Jackson does here. All we know is Ms. Jackson's vague allegation in an affidavit that a supervisor, at a minimum, 4 years before the alleged discrimination that underlies this case took place, made some sort of comment that she has no rights. Well, we don't know that she meant, that this supervisor allegedly meant, even EEO rights. Could have been rights referring to any number of things. The other important difference is that person who allegedly made the comment at least 4 years earlier wasn't even the supervisor about whom Ms. Jackson complained in the religious discrimination claims that she brought that initiated this lawsuit. The notion that it would be reasonable for her, for purposes of employing the equitable tolling or equitable estoppel remedies in her favor in this case, it just doesn't exist. As in Smith, all we have in the way of Ms. Jackson in terms of evidence supporting her claims is her own affidavit. It's, I think this court has routinely held, insufficient to carry her burden in that regard. With respect to notions about whether or not discovery took place, well, I think any claim in that regard has simply been waived. Ms. Jackson easily could have made that. Our opening brief in support of the motion identified this proceeding as a motion to dismiss or in the alternative for summary judgment. There was no mystery about what was going on here. Her failure to make that argument or request discovery, which Rule 56 provides a procedure for, during the briefing or before the decision by the district court or even after it, before her appeal, simply results in a waiver of any such claim that discovery was necessary or inappropriately denied here. And discovery wasn't necessary. The record is complete. Ms. Jackson had ample information in the form of employee training that she received on multiple occasions detailing the EEO process. She received written literature at these trainings, and she admits, both in her appeal at the administrative level as well as in her brief before this court, that she was aware of the posters hanging in her workplace for years detailing an employee's rights. This poster or these posters referred to any employee, made no distinction regarding status, and in fact, a copy of the poster is in the record, in record item number 24, which is our opening brief in support of our motion, at Exhibit A, page 7, and that clearly identifies there's a 45-day time limit here. So I think there's just, as the court held in Smith, it's disingenuous for Ms. Jackson to argue otherwise here, and unless there are any further questions from the panel, we would ask that you affirm.
Mr. Andrew, what about this notice that was available in the training sessions that are given to all the employees?
The interesting thing is that counsel argues that you shouldn't pay any attention to the fact that she was told she didn't have any rights at the same time that she was supposedly receiving this training that he now wants you to say should have alerted her that she had rights. The exact same time that she's seeing these posters and that she's seeing all of this so-called training that says you have rights, her supervisor at that time is telling her she has none, none whatsoever. Counsel wants to point out the fact that there was nothing in the posters or anything that was said that distinguished casual employees from regular. That really is kind of the point. My client is being told that she's a casual employee. There's nothing in these posters, nothing in what she was taught that says a casual employee has these rights. A casual employee also has the right to file an EEO complaint, and a casual employee has the right not to be discriminated against. What we're talking about is affirmative action that was taken on behalf of a supervisor, the person she's supposed to go to, according to the regulations, to determine what her rights are, affirmatively telling her, you have no rights. That is the resource that she's supposed to go to according to the training and according to the posters. So if she even looks at the posters and looks at the training and follows through on it, what does she do?
But aren't you supposed to go to an EEO counselor? If your supervisor is the alleged discriminatory person, I think the direction is to go to the EEO counselor, right?
I believe that's correct as the procedure for what you would do if you're a regular employee. The problem, though, is that the literature that was given to her says the responsibility of enforcing EEO rights is with the supervisor. So what she was being even told was, you feel like you've been discriminated against, go to the supervisor. She goes to the supervisor. The supervisor says, you don't have any rights. You have no rights. And with regard to a question previously asked by Judge Coffey, one of the points that was made with regard to the latter supervisors was she had requested time off to go to a convention, and that supervisor told her, Jehovah's Witness convention, and that supervisor told her if she went to that convention, she was going to be fired.
And how long ago was that?
That was the same year she was fired.
So you think that now you can use that 7 years later?
No, that was the same year she was fired.
Yeah.
That was the last year of her employment that she was told that, not the 7 years before. The 7 years before was that at the same time that she's receiving quote-unquote EEOC training about her rights, the supervisor that she is under is telling her she has no rights. So what does she think? Well, she goes to this session and she sits up and listens to all this real nice discussion about the rights of regular employees, union rights and everything else. But she's already been told, and she's repeatedly been told afterwards, you don't have any rights, though. You really don't even have to pay attention to this. You don't have to read this literature. You don't have to do anything. And there is no clear statement that, in fact, what was being told to her. The literature itself makes it clear, go to the supervisor. That was the supervisor. And another point, my client, when she did discover her rights by going to unemployment, within 45 days of that, in February of the following year, this happened on December 31st, she actually did appeal to the government. She went to the Department of Labor. That was the only thing she knew. They bounced her here, bounced her there, bounced her there. And ultimately, when she found out she had to go to the local office, she went directly there, filed, and did everything that she was told to do. For all these reasons, we believe that it's appropriate that this case should be reversed. We're not saying it's wrong that the judge didn't allow discovery. This is not a Rule 56 motion. And so it's a different situation. So what we're saying is that under the procedures that were established, it was not appropriate to do this to this employee.
Thank you, Mr. Andrew. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Tardif. The case is taken under advisement.